for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Ben Franklin once called Germans flocking to Pennsylvania, quote, generally the most stupid sort of their own nation, and he worried they will soon outnumber us. Despite the popular image of America as melting pot, immigrants have often been demonized for diluting the nation's ethnic heritage. Now, in a new book, author and my frequent guest host, Steve Roberts, profiles 13 modern-day immigrant families. He examines their struggle to preserve old traditions and forge new identities in an America sometimes hostile to newcomers. His new book is titled From Every End of This Earth. And Steve Roberts joins me in the studio. We'll welcome your calls, 800-433-8850. Good morning to you, Steve.
Oh, what a pleasure to be here, and I'm so glad to see you feeling better.
Well, I am feeling better, still recovering from this last voice treatment, but it's getting better every day. I'm glad you've written this book, Steve.
Well, thank you, Diane. You and I share a heritage.
You bet.
We're both children of immigrant families, as are most Americans. But in your case, in my case, it's fairly recent. We knew our immigrant forebears. I grew up with grandfather in the house with me in Bayonne, New Jersey, who had been born in Russia and Poland. My other two grandparents lived three blocks away. I know you grew up here in Washington with immigrants surrounding you. And I thought everybody grew up that way. I thought everybody had a grandmother with an accent and never had a babysitter who you weren't related to. I went off to college at Harvard after growing up in this town that was 80% ethnic Catholic and 19% Jewish, which is what I was. I thought Protestants were a tiny minority. But what I wanted to do with this book is update the story. You know, my last book, which you were nice enough to have me on to talk about, My Father's Houses, was a memoir of my own grandparents' immigration here. And because of that heritage, I've always been interested in the subject of immigration. I've always thought it was one of the most dramatic and compelling of human stories. And I wanted to tell what was happening today, update the story that my grandparents lived almost 100 years ago.
And you chose to use a line from President Obama's speech for your title.
I did, and that was, of course, pretty deliberate. I had some titles I wasn't pleased with. I was doing some radio commentary on the day of the inaugural. I heard this speech in which he said, it's the doers, the risk takers, the makers of things who come from every end of this earth to renew America's spirit and promise. And I immediately knew I had the title. I called my publisher instantly. Because he understands this. He said in that speech, the fact that we are a patchwork nation, is the phrase he uses, makes us stronger, not weaker. And that's, in a word, the theme of the book.
But that has, to a certain extent, come into question on the part of some here in this country, worried about illegal immigrants, worried about possible terrorists. But what you have done is to focus on 13 families and talk about their experience as immigrants in this generation, which is very different.
Well, one of my favorite stories is Pablo Romero. Now, you talk, there's so much controversy about immigrants from Mexico, how they don't identify with America, they don't learn the language, they don't become part of the fabric of the country. Pablo Romero dropped out of school at age 11 in a rural Mexican village. There was no school left. He had finished the grades that the town had. He went to work in a brick factory where life was so hard, Diane, that, as he told me, the bricks would sand his fingers raw every day. He'd come home and say, Mom, I can't have warm tortillas. They hurt too much. At 13, he went to California. His father was a bracero, a legal farm worker in California. He spent his entire teenagehood working in the lettuce fields of Salinas, California. To this day, Diane, he's never been to high school, never been to high school. But he did get drafted into the Army. And he goes to Germany. He blossoms in the Army. He reads every book in the postal library. He buys a used Opel, travels all over Europe, comes home, separates from the Army, files for unemployment benefits. A very caring counselor in the unemployment office says, you know, the local community college has a program for kids like you, young Chicanos with sort of an odd background. Goes to the community college, works all day in the lettuce fields, goes to the community college at night, stays until the library closes at midnight. They have to throw him out of the library every night. He gets a scholarship after 2 years to UC Irvine, who's looking for young Hispanics as well. His final year at UC Irvine, a Latino professor says to him, you know, you should consider medical school. He says, medical school? What are you talking about? He said, how many Spanish-speaking doctors are there in Salinas, California? And Pablo's answer was zero.
Zero.
He gets to UCS, University of California, San Francisco Medical School, graduates from the medical school, and thinks, well, maybe I'll become a surgeon and go to Beverly Hills and make a lot of money. He says, no, that's not me. That's not my life. He goes back to Salinas, California, opens a neighborhood medical clinic where 80% of his clients are farm worker families, including the children and grandchildren of the people he worked in the fields with a generation ago. Now, you don't get a better American story.
Steve, how did you find him?
Well, I found him actually because his daughter went to Harvard and is marrying the son of a colleague of mine at George Washington University. But there's an interesting footnote. His daughter, who was half Anglo because Pablo married an Anglo woman, goes to Harvard and really feels confused about Harvard. First of all, she'd never been east, never been to a cold place. And she told me that I was so naive that I thought I could wear flip-flops in the snow at Harvard Yard, that I would be like snowshoes on the top of the snow. She quickly learned that that was wrong, and she resisted medical school. She willfully failed freshman biology, but the pull of her father's work pulled her back. Today, Diane, she's at UCSF Medical School learning to become a doctor. She told me the story when she was a first year. She thought she'd invite her father to come speak to her medical school class. On the eve of the luncheon, she panics. No one's going to come. Who cares about my father? He's just a neighborhood guy. But she has to estimate how many people are going to come because she has to buy sandwiches for lunch. So she thinks, okay, I'll buy 30 and we'll have some left over. 60 of her classmates show up at this lunch to honor her father. And the whole circle comes around, and her father, Pablo, says to me, when I spoke to Kai's class at medical school, I felt like a king. And it just validated this whole life. Except, he says, Diane, I still have nightmares that people come up to me and say, Dr. Romero, it's all a fraud. You never went to high school. You can't be a doctor.
Steve Roberts, his new book is titled From Every End of This Earth, subtitled 13 Families and the New Lives They Made in America. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. One story in your book that really captures the immigrant experience is Bao and Tuyen Pham.
Absolutely. These are Vietnamese family. I know them because their daughter was a student of mine at George Washington University and wrote about their family's journey in my writing class.
You asked them to write
To write about their families. Right. As I tell them, your grandmother never says no comment. But also they capture these histories and they give these wonderful gifts to their families of writing down this history.
Of course.
And Bao, the father of his family, was a naval officer in Vietnam, and he knew on the day Saigon fell that there was no future for him. But he and Tuyen were engaged. They weren't married. And he raced through the burning streets of Saigon from his ship, which is in the harbor, reached her house and pleaded with her, say, come now, leave the country. We can get on a ship. We can leave. She said, no. And I said to her, why didn't you go? She said, because I was not his yet. The notion of leaving with an unmarried, totally out of the question.
Yeah.
That decision cost them 6 years. They spent 6 years in and out of prison, trying to escape, being arrested. He finally got a boat that worked. They got into the open sea. She, by this time, had two children. They got married right after the kid. Two children. She was pregnant with a third. And they had no water. the engine had died. They were drifting in the open sea.
Just their family?
No, there were about 60 people in the boat. And it's a very tiny boat. And she said to me, I saw my children. They were going to die. There was no water. I had one choice, to slit my wrist and feed my children my blood. And fortunately, it did not come to that. They drifted and saw land. Now, if it was Cambodia, they'd probably be killed. If it was Thailand, they'd probably be safe. I had no idea what it was. So he calls out, basically, where are we? And the answer would determine whether they lived or died. And it was Thailand.
Wow.
And their daughter, my student, was born they were in Thailand for a few months, and then they moved to the Philippines for processing before they came to America. She was born in a refugee camp in the Philippines. Her name is Thai Phi for the two countries, Thailand and the Philippines, mm-hmm. that gave her family refuge. And Tuyen said to me, we are the sacrifice generation. It's a wonderful phrase, Diane, because it captures something profound about the immigrant experience that you and I know firsthand. And that is that the generation comes are never fully at home in their new country, but they can never really go back to the old country either. They're the bridge. They're the sacrifice. They're the generation that makes our lives possible in the new country.
And just imagine saying goodbye to the country that you have been born in,
exactly.
that you know, that you live in. You're leaving behind friends, relatives. You're going
graves,
to,
memories,
you
records.
Have no idea what you'll find.
You know, one of the women in this book, Marie Aziz from Afghanistan, said, it's the song of the reed, the pain of separation that you hear when the reed is blown. That phrase, the pain of separation, has been true for every immigrant in the history of the world, Diane.
Steve Roberts. The book is titled From Every End of This Earth. Stay with us. You know, Steve Roberts, when my mother came here to this country, she hid. She came here from Alexandria, Egypt, and she would never really become part of the community. It was simply her relatives, her sisters-in-law, her brothers-in-law, that made up her circle. Now it's different.
It is different. I had the same experience. As I said, my grandparents, I had one in the house with me. The other two lived three blocks away.
Exactly.
I mean, the family circle. My aunt and uncle lived one town over. It was like they had moved to a foreign country. Whoever moved to Jersey City from Bayonne. But the what is different, there are many things that are different. What never changes is this pain, as you put it so well, of leaving your family, leaving your homeland, leaving the food you've grown up, the water you've tasted, all of these things that send these messages of home. But one of the things that's different is one sociologist called the feminization of immigration, because women, unlike your mother's generation, my grandmother's generation, are now much more capable of being independent, both culturally and socially, as well as economically. So there is Marie Aziz in the book, who's Afghani, who came as a single mom with a three-year-old daughter, landed here in Washington. She actually was a descendant of the last king of Afghanistan, but she had a tough time supporting herself. At one point, she literally had to pawn the crown jewels. She had jewels that she had inherited from her family to pay the rent here in Washington. When her daughter got sick, she couldn't leave her home. She had no babysitter, so she would bring her daughter. She was working in her first job at a company that sold gear for police organizations and Secret Service, and they had a pile of bulletproof armored vests in the back room, and her daughter would take a nap on the armored vests in the back room. That's the only thing she could do with it.
But how did she feel about America once she got here?
Well, that's a good question. And I think she identified very strongly with its freedoms, both as a woman, because she had been pushed into an arranged marriage and felt herself a pawn in a social network that where she could not be an independent person. She was a little unusual. She had actually come to America for college. She had a degree from Bryn Mawr. But also, it was the land of opportunity. But with her story exemplifies, and what so many of them do, is that it's not that the streets of America are paved with gold.
Mm.
They're not. Mm. The streets of America are paved with opportunity to make something of yourself. What Marie did, and what so many of the people of the in this book did, they didn't have anything handed to them. They didn't come looking for food stamps or welfare. The ones who succeeded, the ones who worked the hardest, it's that simple. And so this notion that somehow, that some immigrants have and some romanticists have, that you come to America and all will be well, that's not true. You come to America and have a chance to make something of yourself, but you've got to do it yourself.
But considering the economy these mm-hmm. days, considering the lack of job opportunities these days, it would seem to me that fewer and fewer people think of America as the place to go.
It's a real issue. There's no doubt about it. And some of the latest statistics show that some of the immigration has fallen off. But also remember, this is a comparative question.
Yeah.
Eddie Kamara Stanley, who came from Sierra Leone, a political refugee, his father and brother were decapitated by rebels. His sister was seized as a sex slave and totally traumatized by the experience. He made it to America, eventually brought his family over. Now, Eddie is not a wealthy man. He's been sick, and he has never had a very good job in America. His wife supports them, working as an orderly in a hospital. Eddie can scrape together about $100 every few months to send to his mother in Sierra Leone, and that's a fortune to her. So while the economic opportunities in America are restricted, this process of sending money back home is still an extremely mm-hmm. important process,
yeah.
And even his minor income makes a huge difference back home.
Here's an email from Nat in Louisville. He says the idea that people from all over the globe come to this land to create their future is such an American story. Why then are we at the same time so hostile to new immigrants?
It's a great question, and it's not new. We've had spasms of anti-immigrant feeling throughout our entire history. No Irish need apply. At one point, Italians in this country were considered non-white in some places because they were so swarthy and dark-skinned. I think it's aggravated, Diane, at times of economic stress when people feel they're in competition with immigrants for jobs. They want to blame somebody. This is happening today. They want to blame somebody, and it's an easy target. And there are times and places where particularly illegal immigration will flood a town, flood a school system, flood a hospital. I'm not minimizing those circumstances. But what is also true is a lot of immigrants are job creators. If the people listening to us think about who was running the 7-Eleven in their neighborhood? It's a Korean family. It's a Pakistani family. I'm willing to bet in most cases. Who is running the local laundry? Who's running the local landscaping business? People create jobs because they're entrepreneurs. They're job-creating engines. Every economic study shows this. And on the high end, and talking about the high-tech end, why does Bill Gates come to Congress pleading with Congress to increase the number of visas for graduates of our computer sciences and our engineering schools? Because he knows that ideas have no boundaries. And if we don't retain and keep the best minds, they're going to go to Germany, they're going to go to Australia, they're going to go to Canada. And as one commentator said to me, if we're so stupid as to not to keep these people, the next Silicon Valley is going to be in Shanghai or Mumbai. It's not going to be in California.
But, Steve, you've heard the same arguments I have, that so few jobs are available. Why should they go to immigrants? Why should any health care rewards go to especially non-legal immigrants?
Well, non-legal immigrants are a whole special issue, and I don't deal very much with that in this book because it's a whole set of questions. And those are real issues. And America has an obligation to police its borders. It has an obligation to limit access to public taxpayer-funded programs. I understand that, and I agree with that. But I also think the 12 million who are here illegally are not going to go home, and we have to find a way to regularize them. It is a real question in times of economic stress, but as I say, I repeat, they create jobs. Physics prize, for, Nobel Prize for Physics, went to three Americans, two foreign-born, one from China, one from Canada. What did they create? Fiber optics and digital television. Think about how many Americans are working today based on those two technologies.
On the other hand, you've got so many immigrants who come here who are overqualified for the jobs they
That's
take
true.
Simply because they have to work, and they'll work at anything.
That is true. And I have a number of cases of people who have simply had to take jobs like this. We talked about the Pham family from Vietnam. He was a college-educated person. He had been a military officer. He gets to Lancaster, Pennsylvania, and he's not fluent enough in English or skilled enough to really get a white-collar job. He's worked his whole life running a press in a printing plant in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. And but he works so hard that he takes every extra shift in the factory. Whenever there's an extra, he works 18 straight days, often two shifts a day. The factory makes him take a day off on the 19th day. If they didn't, he'd still work.
Wow.
He'd work 19 days.
Wow.
But he has built a home for his family. He has a beautiful home in Lancaster that he's financed. His three kids have all gone to college. When you the argument that somehow these immigrants are taking something from America, that they're here to a free ride on food stamps or medical care. Look at Bao Pham. That man works as hard as any American I have ever met, Diane. And he's as good an American and as patriotic American as anybody I've ever met.
Steve Roberts, and the book we're talking about is titled From Every End of This Work. And we're going to open the phones now, 800-433-8850. To first to Laurel, Maryland. Good morning, Ed. You're on the air.
Thank you, Diane. I can't believe this. You made my day.
I'm glad.
I think you are an American icon and something for all of us immigrants to look up to. My question and congratulations to Steve.
Thank
is,
you.
I listen to this show every day, and this is my first time getting through. What is it is the most important thing that made you write this book? Is it the election of our own president? I have to say that because I'm an immigrant. Mm-hmm. And or is it something else? Because I feel that the election of Barack Obama, in my mind, gave a rebirth to this great nation.
Hmm. Interesting.
Well, thank you, Ed. I had this idea before he was president, but there's certainly true that his story reinforces the theme of the book. And his own speeches, he's made several speeches about immigration and emphasized the strength that immigrants bring to America. It's been a strong theme of his. And he has promised to deal with the legal question next year. We'll see whether he has time to do it. But he stands as a symbol of the virtues of the immigrant contribution of America. Two other things, though. And one is my own family, as Diane and I were talking about. I've always been inspired by their journey and their story. And also, my students at George Washington wrote about their own families and reminded me that the same vibrancy, the same vitality that my grandparents demonstrated 100 years ago is alive and well today. And I didn't do it because I wanted to counteract the anti-immigration feeling in America. And that was not my purpose, but I'm glad it's having that effect because it comes out at a time when I hope it will be useful in counteracting that feeling.
Thanks for calling, Ed. Let's go now to Northeast Alabama. Good morning, Stephen.
Thank you. Steve, I live in the most ethnically diverse town in the state. It was the subject of a statewide documentary on the Hispanic influx in the last 10 years. To cut to the chase, I don't speak officially in no official capacity, but there's a junior college in the area that's connected to some of the most powerful forces in the state of Alabama. It would be quite interesting here in Jeff Sessions' home state if there is a way that I can contact you after this, see if you could with their working with it, if they like the idea, for you to come here and maybe get Carol Swain from Vanderbilt University, who has written about immigrants and who kind of lines up very conservative on the immigration ideal, but her personal story is quite remarkable. Number one, I'll try to follow up, contact you through George Washington University, but are you aware of Carol Swain at Vanderbilt and her work and her personal story? And I hope the conversation between you and her continues somewhere. It's a remarkable book.
Stephen, thank you.
Well, I'm not familiar with her work, and I appreciate your letting me know about it. Often the work of people who are praising immigrants and who are celebrating their virtues gets overwhelmed, not only in the book sphere these days, but even more on cable television, where there are a number of noteworthy voices who keep shouting. And I hope that Carol Swain's work, along with mine, will counteract that a bit.
At 27 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And now to Ann Arbor, Michigan. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Diane and Steve. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
Great, thank you.
Thanks for a couple minutes. I appreciate the perspective, Steve, that you're taking by going straight to the source of the stories and the terrific life experiences of immigrants in America. If we go back far enough, we all have some stories that could be told on our behalf.
Mm-hmm.
But I wanted to just kind of lay this out there, separate maybe from the individual stories that you show in your book. There are so many people that I run into on a day-to-day basis who find it extremely easy to criticize immigrants without actually knowing any. And I find this very disturbing. Like I told someone the other day, okay, you tell me that you don't appreciate immigrants taking jobs or any of the stereotypes that are being thrown around, but would you say that to their face? If you met them at a party and you found out that they came, you know, either first or second generation from anywhere else, would you take them to task in the same way that you did in an anonymous fashion? So I there's no real answer to this. I just kind of wanted to throw that out there.
Yeah, I think this is true of almost any prejudice. You know, it's much easier to hate people, whether you hate them for their race, their gender, their sexual orientation, to hate them in the abstract.
And, if they're standing in front of you, it's totally different.
It is totally different, at least in most cases. That's one of the reasons why I've written a book, because I wanted to put a face, a human face, on this experience and let people see the virtues as well as the criticism.
John, thanks for calling. Let's go now to Copenhagen and to Evie. Good morning, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, thank you. This sounds like a fantastic book. I can't wait to get it
and read good.
It. I have an immigrant story, kind of a double immigration story that I think makes a good point. My family came from Eastern Europe, from Russia and Poland and such, 100 years ago, before World War One and after World War One, before World War Two, over to the United States, and settled there and became successful and all of that. And then two generations later, I meet a Danish guy, and I moved to Denmark. And my family, my ancestors stood on the ship, waving goodbye to the people on the shore, knowing that they would never see them again, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That's the way it was back then. I, you know, say goodbye to my folks at the airport, knowing that they're going to come in 6 months and, you know, merrily go on my way and go back and forth almost at will, you know? And I just think it's interesting how much the world has changed.
Oh, you bet.
Evie, you make a wonderful point. Some things about immigration never change. We were talking about the pain of separation, the longing for your homeland. But some things are different today. We talked about the feminization of immigration. Another development you put your finger on is communications. When my grandfather left Russia and Poland, he was out of touch with his own sister for 50 years. 50 years.
Not even
not a
telephone
letter, not a,
call, nothing.
She was behind the Iron Curtain.
Yeah.
There was just no way to find her.
Absolutely.
They actually met each other right toward the end of their lives when a relative got out to Israel, wrote to him saying, you know, you have a sister alive. But Evie's experience is very common today. Asis Banerjee, in my book, grew up in a very remote village in rural India. His mother still lives there, no running water, but she has a cell phone. He talks to her every day by cell phone. And this communication has changed it. Eddie Kamara talks to his mother by cell phone back in Sierra Leone, and she doesn't always, because the connection isn't always good, she doesn't always know who it is, and she's elderly. So he tells me there's a childhood nursery rhyme that she used to sing to him, and he sings it to her, and then she knows it's him.
That's a beautiful story. We're going to take a short break. Evie, thanks for your call. I hope you see your family again soon.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Annie E. Casey Foundation, working to help vulnerable kids and families succeed at aecf.org. By the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy. By the Gruber Family Foundation, to extend the breadth and depth of NPR's international coverage. And by the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, your source for what works in public education. Learn more at edutopia.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, Spike Jonze, the director of Being John Malkovich, an adaptation, talks about his new film, Where the Wild Things Are, adapted from Maurice Sendak's children's book. Also, Pulitzer Prize-winning music critic Tim Page talks about getting diagnosed with Asperger syndrome at the age of 45 and how it helped explain his strengths and weaknesses. He has a new memoir. Join us.
Your questions for Steve Roberts, his new book, From Every End of This Earth. Here's an email, and it's from Meg, who says, regarding the demonization of immigrants, I think it's more than just economic downturn. I think immigrants are an easy target for right-wing talk show hosts who turn public unrest away from appropriate targets like Wall Street and a group of others who virtually never fight back due to justifiable fear.
There's a lot of truth to that.
I agree.
I think that it's easy to demonize people who don't look like the rest of us, but you know, America is changing in such a wonderfully way, I think. I was at a wedding of a former student in Tampa, Florida, a couple of weeks ago. She's of Indian heritage. She was marrying an Anglo. I looked around the room, And there were these dozens and dozens of these beautiful Indian women in these saris, and they were all dark skinned. And the flower girls. One was this short, peppery, dark skinned Indian kid, and one was this sort of pale, willowy Anglo kid. And these two little girls are walking down the aisle. I said to the bride, "This is America." And so I understand what the caller's saying. I agree with it, but I think in the future, it's going to be harder and harder to demonize people of color, people from other countries, because they are us. They're not the other anymore. They are us.
All right. To Charlottesville, Virginia. Good morning, Daisy. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm so glad that you had Steve on again. I work as an anthropologist freelance, and I just held a workshop at American University, Understanding Exclusion and Initiating Dialogue with Latino Populations. So my concern is legal status, and I know you didn't broach this subject too much, but in human rights terms, I think the legality in and out of status issue is a guise for perpetuating prejudice. And I'm concerned that, you know, it's something that people think is an okay thing to do. Wondering whether someone is or isn't legal allows them to treat them inappropriately. And I am a wife of an immigrant from Costa Rica, actually. And so I see how difficult it is for him and for our children. I'm wondering what you have to say about that. I'm sure you touch on a few of those points with your stories.
Well, Daisy, I do think that it can be, and the debate over legalization can serve as a, in some ways, as a more proper or a disguised surrogate for more racist or more xenophobic feelings. But I also think that you have to be fair on the subject of illegal immigration. I think that I'm all for a program that would eventually provide citizenship for the people who are here. Let's remember, a lot of them are taxpayers. A lot of them have children who are citizens. They are very much a part of the fabric of this country. But they have broken the law, and they should pay a price for it, whether it's a fine, whether it's getting to the back of the line. We should exclude the ones who are criminals. I think from a moral point of view, that's necessary. It's also necessary from a political point of view. If we're going to solve the biggest part of this problem and find legal status for most of these immigrants, which I think is in America's interest, we have to understand that politically, you have to prove that you're also serious about controlling
Absolutely.
Your borders.
Absolutely. Thanks for calling, Daisy. You know, I think we haven't talked about a subject that, for me, really represents the immigrant experience, and that's food.
Absolutely.
It is so important as part of retaining that sense of heritage. But, you know, I went through a rebellious period in my teenage years, as most of us did.
What a surprise.
What a surprise. And sort of rejecting my mother's wonderful Arabic food and saying, well, why can't we just have American
Chef
hamburgers
Boyardee,
or something like that? But, you know, now the smells, the wonderful tastes of those foods just make me long for my parents.
It's absolutely right. Food is such a resonant part of this experience. And it's also a part of the cultural heritage. It's one of the ways in which traditions get handed down.
Absolutely.
Mothers and daughters, mothers and grandmothers in the kitchen. You're not just sharing recipes. You're sharing stories. You're sharing legends. You're sharing myths. You're sharing
memories. You know, it's also mothers and sons. I must tell you that every Christmas, my son comes down from Gettysburg to bake baklava with me, which we offer
what a
to
blessing.
All of us. It really is.
What
it's a wonderful blessing.
And there's another way in which food plays a very important part, and that is one of the main ways immigrants create small businesses is based on their native foods. Because you think about immigrants, what do they have to offer in the business marketplace? They don't have much money, generally. But they have recipes, and they have their sweat, and they have the ability to work very hard. And restaurants, food service is the kind of business where you can really create something through your own effort without a lot of money. And there are two families in this book, one from Greece, one from El Salvador, both of whom created restaurants based on, in many ways, their native cuisines. And in the Salvadoran case, the first business was a billiard hall, and the woman, Betty Reyes, grew up in a village where her first job when she was about 7 or 8 years old, her grandmother would make tamales, and she would go around the village selling them. And she learned from her grandmother the recipe, and their first stake in American economy, she would make these tamales in her kitchen, bring them over to the billiard parlor where her husband presided, in the beer parlor, then sell them to the billiard players. They now own one of the most successful restaurants here in Adams Morgan District of Washington.
That's great. Let's go now to Demetra, who's in Kerrville, Texas. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. I'm a journalist from Alaska. I'm visiting my mother in Kerrville, Texas. And I just wanted to say that every time I take a taxi or go to the airport because my mom needs a wheelchair, I ask the people working there, where are you from? And then I ask them, would you rather be here or home?
Hmm.
And they always say they would rather be home.
Huh.
And it seems to me that we've become a world of refugees from economic disruption and warfare, and that I think that a lot of that has occurred because of America's foreign policy and the restrictive measures of the World Bank. It's interesting that, for instance, we never gave any money to Vietnam after the war, and yet if you go to any nail shop, it's like practically a dynasty of Vietnamese cleaning your feet and doing your nails, which I find kind of disturbing. Whereas, for instance, after World War II, when we gave support to Japan, we did not experience an influx of Japanese folks to this country.
Steve?
Well, I'm not going to discuss the World Bank because I'm not quite sure what she's referring to. I do think, as we discussed earlier, there is a lot of emotional cost to immigration.
Of course.
And a lot of people who will say, I'd rather be home. Mm-hmm. I'd rather be eating the food back home. I'd rather be tasting the water back home and breathing the air. But they come here for the economic opportunity, and then they become American, you know, and their kids become American, and they settle here. And a lot of people who say, I'm going to go back home, never do, because their grandchildren are here. And I don't see anything, I don't find it disturbing that Vietnamese or Koreans are doing nails or pedicures. This is honorable work. They're working hard. They're serving, you know, a need. They're building a business. They're feeding their families. This is honorable work. I have no problem with that.
All right. To Farmington Hills, Michigan. Leica, you're on the air.
Hi, Diane.
Hello.
Hi. I love your show. Thank you for having me.
Of course.
I am a legal immigrant from India. And, you know, I just had two comments. One is I think people don't see from him. I agree with Steve when he said I'm kind of in that mode where I've achieved a lot of success here. And I think over time, you know, I was in the beginning, in between, you know, whether I should go back or whether I should be here. And then over time, when you start having all this opportunity, no matter what you say, you know, India is growing, everything, but this is a land of opportunity. I would never get what I have here. And then you know, because you have such great experiences, because of an attitude of what you have towards Americans, it's still the land of opportunity. I would never go back. And, you know, Americanism grows on you. You become more of an American over time, I think. And I think maybe people don't understand it, maybe because some of them are ignorant. And I see that. I've never had bad experiences, but I know people who have had. And it's amazing that, you know, I see this and I say, well, I am an American now. I may have Indian friends and stuff, but deep down, I am an American. And that's amazing that when I think about it.
Interesting.
Lovely phone call. Thank you. There's an Indian family in my book that reflects a lot of the themes you're talking about. Asis Banerjee came to America for grad school, Case Western, chemistry. You know, got on a plane. There was nothing dramatic about his trip. He and Indira married when she was quite young. And they've moved back and forth. They lived 14 years back in India. Today, he has two high-tech plastics factories, one in Medina, Ohio, one in Tamil Nadu in India. He represents another theme that's very interesting and different, and that is the growth of international commerce, often managed and fueled by immigrants. If you think about it, and this is particularly true of Asians, Indian and Chinese, with the growth of trade with Asia, someone like Aziz, he understands the language back home. He understands the culture. He has tribal or community connections. And so it is, immigrants are often very well positioned to trade with their home countries. And that is a new theme that we're seeing more and more of.
Now, here's another viewpoint from Richard in Rockville, Maryland. He says, I certainly support and enjoy your uplifting stories about the contributions that immigrants have made and are making to this country. However, the numbers of these successful and uplifting stories pale when compared to the numbers of unsuccessful, uneducated immigrants who come to this country illegally and undermine the fabric of the country, milk the system with their unrelenting demands for housing, health and education, welfare assistance, including food stamps and everything else. This is what Americans resent, especially when they see these people, many of whom are unemployed, walking the streets with numerous children, receiving aid while contributing little or nothing to the general welfare. And producer Susan Neighbor says, surprisingly, we are getting lots of emails like this one.
Well, it's a point of view, and I'm not saying it's completely wrong. I think any honest assessment has to say that there are times and places where local school systems, local hospitals are overwhelmed, and that is true. And I think as a nation, we do have to police our borders better. And I am not in favor of giving social welfare aid without strings to illegal immigrants. But what the caller is missing is several things. The fact is a lot of even the illegal immigrants contribute a lot to this country. They do pay taxes. They do take jobs that a lot of Americans don't want. My mother got sick last year. She was in the hospital in suburban Maryland. Every single person who took care of my mother was a foreign-born woman of color. Every single one. If you took those people out of that hospital, Diane, it would collapse tomorrow.
But you're not suggesting they were here illegally.
Some of them might have come originally illegally, but these were legal immigrants, and you do have to make that distinction. But even the illegal immigrants, they do jobs Americans don't want. They pay taxes, and they often start businesses. I'm not defending everything about illegal immigration, but this was an unbalanced view of their role in America.
At 6 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And to Falls Church, Virginia, Arturo, you're on the air.
Hi, Diane. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Well, it's good to have you with us, sir.
I was going to make a comment because I think one of the reasons why I came here 20 years ago, maybe a little more than that. And I came with kids. Now the kids have more kids. So I'm a grandpa already after 20 years in here. And, you know, the majority of the people that make comments about the people come and doesn't have good education, or they may don't have the skills to have a technical job. It is true in a way. And I think if we keep in mind that the only Americans in here was the Native Americans, everybody came somewhere, somehow, back in time, you know?
Yes.
So there are maybe the parents of the people that made those comments came without that that advantage, without the education, without the language, without skills. And then they had kids in here, and those kids went to school, and those kids got skills, they got educations, and they went up. You know, maybe the grandparents did it, you know? But the thing is, even that we are in a bad economy, even though we are in a bad situation for jobs, there is not another country in the world like this.
Well, the fact is that, as you point out, we've said this several times, that the generation that comes often lacks the skills or the education to to do more than menial jobs. Their kids often do go to college. There's a family from Burma, three Muslim sisters. Their father has had a hard time in America. He's never found good work. Their mother cleans office buildings for a living. All three of these young women went to college. Two are now in graduate school. And I asked one of them, she said to me, you know, I just had to fill in a application for graduate school, and it asked me, who am I? And I said, Hafsa, what did you say? She said, I'm a Muslim, I'm an immigrant, I'm my mother's daughter, and I'm a strong woman of color. And then she pauses and says to me, and I'm a California chick.
What a great finale to this conversation, Steve. The book is titled From Every End of This Earth. Steve Roberts, congratulations. Good book. People are going to enjoy it.
Thank you so much for having me, Diane.
My pleasure. And thanks for sitting in for me. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Anisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org.